Of the many, many questions raised by last night's election, this one is perhaps the most fundamental. What happens now? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is the 9th of November, Wednesday, not an ordinary Wednesday, though, as we all know. So we are going to do something out of the ordinary to get going. A midweek chat, a rare midweek chat with Catherine Rampell of The Washington Post. Also, David Gura from Bloomberg about what happens now. That will be, by the way, the theme of the broadcast today. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
So, Catherine, let me start with you. You know, there was so much in Donald Trump's campaign, so very, very much, right? And let me just stipulate at the beginning that there was a lot of it that was racist and misogynist. But the people who, it seems to me, voted for Trump were voting on his economic promise, right? He made a lot of economic promises. The question is, can he deliver on that economy?
I fear not. He has made a lot of very fantastical promises that he is just simply unable to keep, many of which seem frankly cruel to me, about bringing back jobs in the coal industry, which have been displaced by innovation, productivity, fracking, amongst other things, bringing back jobs in manufacturing, many of which have been displaced by automation, amongst other forces. A lot of these particular types of promises, they're easy to make. They've raised hopes. I don't think they'll be borne out. And then on plenty of other policies as well, you know, if he is successful, it's not clear that it will be good for the economy. For example, increasing tariffs, placing huge tariffs on imports from Mexico and China. These seem very likely to create a trade war, to cause a recession here and abroad, and lead to millions of job losses.
So even if he's successful, he's not successful. Right. So, David, do we get a wink and a nod toward those promises and then the old hands in Washington prevail, granted that those are now going to be Republican hands on the levers of power?
Yeah, that's a big question. I mean, I think what Catherine's getting at is the burden of expectations here on Donald Trump is huge. You look at the states he was able to win last night. She talked about coal mining, Pennsylvania, Ohio, manufacturing, Michigan, Wisconsin. These are voters who heard something in what he was saying. I think that he's going to try to deliver something to them just because he has to do that. As for what happens in Washington, you look back at sort of before the election, all that we heard about who might be doing what in a Hillary Clinton administration. We didn't hear that about a Donald Trump administration. There are a few names being floated for a Treasury secretary, but that's about it. So you look at the work that this transition team has to do here in a couple of months. It's a huge undertaking, and we'll have to see how much new blood he's able to bring into Washington, how much, as you say, he's going to have to rely on people who know the city and know how things work there.
So, Catherine, when you look at what pass for policy proposals on his website, right, which are, we should be upfront about this, they're not policy proposals. They're very brief outlines of what he intends to do. When you look at that, and I say to you the word uncertainty and this economy, what's your response?
I foresee a lot of volatility going forward because there's so much uncertainty about what he will do, what his actual policies are, what the details are. And he has laid out some details. I don't want to give him too short of shrift. He has laid out some details, like on tax policy, but there are some big holes in them as well. And, you know, there are a lot of other sources of uncertainty beyond what we traditionally consider economic policy, including geopolitical risks. Those play out both, you know, in terms of our military and diplomatic capacities, but also in the global economy. And given that we don't exactly understand what his philosophy is on, from a foreign policy standpoint, and how well he would handle confrontations or negotiations with other countries, despite the fact that he calls himself a great negotiator, all of that lends itself to much greater uncertainty, much greater volatility within markets and between countries.
David, quickly-ish, this idea of uncertainty. I mean, we saw it in the markets last night. The futures crashed, and then, holy cow, we're up toward record highs on the Dow.
This was a record for me. I was on air for the Asian Open, the European Open, and the U.S. Open.
Show up. It was startling.
I humble brag there. Startling to see that decline in futures when they went down about 700 points. The Dow futures went down 700 points. It was startling here. I think a big question is, how is he going to work with this Republican Congress? He's got the House in the Senate, but his relationship with the House Speaker, Paul Ryan, has been tenuous, to say the least, and it'll be interesting to see how that shakes out.
David Bloomberg from David Gura, rather, from Bloomberg Television. You saw him on the air pretty much all night last night. And Catherine Rampell from The Washington Post. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, Guy.
Thanks, Guy.
All right, we'll see you. Wall Street, we talked about just a bit. It was a Trump rally this day after Election Day. We'll have the details when we do the numbers.
I just wish people could be fair. Just fair, you know? Do you get tired of feeling like the underdog, pumping and sweating every day? You just don't feel like it's worth it. And there are people that don't have to work as hard, but they reap more benefits than others do.
That was Amara Newton from District Heights, Maryland there. We're going to pick a couple of topic areas today, stuff that played out in the election last night. We're going to look a little bit at what happened, and then mostly, as I said up on top, talk about what happens now. Item one, the very real economic disconnect in this country, the gap between the headline numbers and people's own economies that we have been reporting on for the better part of a year now. Marketplace's Abri Benishore has that one.
Steve Staub runs Staub Manufacturing. They work with sheet metal in Dayton, Ohio.
I'm feeling very excited today.
He voted for Trump, and for Staub, the economy is key.
The average person that I know here in industrial-based Dayton, Ohio area isn't doing as well as they feel they could be doing.
Now, here's where a sort of mystery emerges. Dayton's unemployment rate is 5.5%. It's slightly above the national average, but not terrible. And Staub himself, he's doing okay. But he has, up till now, felt a great deal of anxiety about the economy.
I know a lot of people struggle every day trying to put food on the table. We've got so many people underemployed. We still have machinists that are working at fast food restaurants.
And he's painfully aware of long-term trends in the U.S. economy.
Carrier air conditioners is closing a plant an hour from me. They're moving that plant to Mexico.
This starts to get at the divide between the data and how people feel. The things Staub is describing aren't necessarily captured in, say, the unemployment rate. Paul Gronke is professor of political science at Reed College.
There's been a much more dramatic bump in income among higher income groups.
And the middle has shrunk. Kim Parker is with the Pew Research Center.
The highest and lowest income groups have gotten bigger, while the middle class, middle income group has gotten smaller.
One demographic, Parker says, that suffered the most is Americans with no college education and low skills, precisely the group that Donald Trump tried to champion in this election. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
From the very day of his announcement, Donald Trump's proposed policies on immigration helped pave the way to the White House for him. He has called for mass deportations of undocumented immigrants, the wall, of course, the Muslim ban. Bearing all of that in mind, and also that according to a study from the Partnership for a New American Economy, immigrants made up a fifth of all entrepreneurs in this country in 2014 and generated more than $65 billion worth of business activity. We wanted to see how some of those business owners are feeling about their economic futures. Marketplace's Rima Kreis has that one.
Mansoor Eskandari was up until 2 o'clock this morning watching the election returns. And like much of America, he was not prepared for what happened.
Very much surprised.
Eskandari lives in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. He's an Iranian immigrant who came here in 1984.
At the same time, I'm a Muslim, too. So double jeopardy.
He owns a construction business that employs about a dozen immigrants. He says over the years he's had trouble finding workers, and now with Trump.
If he's going to deport people, I mean, it's going to affect my business directly because it's going to get worse.
Rami Koraki shares his worries. He owns El Tayebat Market, the oldest Middle Eastern grocery store in Anaheim, California. It's in a neighborhood known as Little Arabia.
Some of our produce guys were kind of joking around the other day saying, oh, well, you know, maybe tomorrow there won't be any employees here to work.
Last year, a bullet-riddled copy of the Quran was found outside a nearby store. Koraki says he's afraid Trump's election will increase anti-Muslim sentiment.
When 9/11 happened, we had, someone had called in a bomb threat. We've had several people call in and leave threatening, you know, voicemails.
Viridiana Martinez, an undocumented immigrant and activist, doesn't support Trump, but she's not afraid of his stance on immigration.
Donald Trump is a businessman above everything. And, you know, he's hired illegal workers.
She says politicians talk a lot, Obama included, but are short on action. I'm Rima Kreis for Marketplace.
One of the most disturbing things is about this election is, you know, the sense of that we're going to bring jobs back, and it's nonsense. What really is going on is we're fundamentally changing our economy, and most jobs that we probably lost, we've lost it to automation, not necessarily trade policies, and we better be adapting to the new economy.
That was Jeffrey Stiles. He's in Fairfax, Virginia. There are a whole bunch of questions about last night that aren't now what. They're more along the lines of something you'd ask a pollster, like, what happened and why did so many people get it not right? Thankfully, we know a pollster. Larry Rosen is the president of Edison Research. They're the ones who do the official exit polls for presidential elections. And not for nothing, they were also our partners in our Marketplace Edison Research Economic Survey that came out, a month or so ago. Larry, it's good to talk to you again.
Hi, Kai.
I wonder maybe if the place to start with this conversation about polling and exit polls and this election is how little it seems we knew about ourselves, given the way things turned out.
Well, yeah, I mean, the polling industry, especially the pre-election pollsters, are definitely going to have to regroup and try to figure out why most of them seem to be projecting a Hillary victory, in fact, a rather easy Hillary victory. And then in the end, that's not what happened. You know, when it comes to elections, a huge part is who's going to show up and vote. Mm-hmm. And I think most of that analysis is going to come down to turnout. And that really seems to be a huge part of the story of the election.
Let me drill down into a couple of data points on this thing. And I'm looking now at your results from your exit polls yesterday. Hillary Clinton won those who thought the economy was good and fair and obviously lost horribly to those who thought the economy was lousy. And that can't be a surprise to anybody.
Right. And that was truly one of the most predictive items in the exit poll. Only a tiny number of people think the national economy is excellent, and they overwhelmingly went for Clinton. A third of people think it's good, and they overwhelmingly went for Clinton. But among the majority of people who said it's not good or poor, 62% of people said the national economy is either not good or poor, and they went for Trump in very, very large numbers.
Were you surprised by any of this?
Not that Trump won those groups, it's just the magnitude. It wasn't that people who felt the economy was doing poorly would vote for Trump. It's just that how many people felt that way in the first place and how that's what put them over.
As you try to at a dinner party on Friday or Saturday night where you're going to go to unwind after a crazy beginning of the week, how are you going to explain this to your friends over a beer or a glass of wine?
Yeah, we're still sort of processing and trying to understand. But the one thing I'm really focused in on is turnout. Donald Trump found a way to motivate groups who hadn't turned out to vote for instance, Mitt Romney 4 years ago or John McCain 8 years ago in significant enough numbers. And all of a sudden, states, especially across the northern tier of this country, Pennsylvania, Ohio, he came very, very close in Michigan and Minnesota. He won Wisconsin, easily won Iowa. All of a sudden, these states started flipping. And that, to me, was a huge part of the story.
Were those voters just hidden? Were they not contacted by pollsters? Did they not answer with what they eventually thought was going to happen? I'm talking now, obviously, in the pre-election polls.
Yeah, and honestly, I don't know yet, and no one knows yet. I mean, the shy Trump theory is going to be widely discussed, that pollsters talked to them and they either said they hadn't decided or that they said that they would vote for someone else. But once inside the voting booth, they came to a different conclusion. It's early days, and mm-hmm. there's going to be tons of analysis. I'll happily come back. But I mean, I'm not dodging your question when I say I don't know, and I'm pretty sure no one yet knows the answer.
Larry Rosen is the president of Edison Research. He is, I should say, in case you missed it earlier this year, they were our partners on the Marketplace Edison Research economic surveys that we did. Larry, thanks very much.
Of course, Kai.
We've got more from Larry Rosen in his guide to the exit polls. It is, of course, at marketplace.org.
I might cry. It's been a rough day. I know a lot of people are worried about health care, and now I'm worried about how many people aren't going to have it. I have a daughter that has Down syndrome, and I worry about what benefits will not be available to her any longer.
Immigration. Take care of the immigration. Get rid of them. If they're not here legally, we don't need it. Because they're taking our jobs. I'm a union worker, and they're taking our union work. They're coming over, and they're doing more work for less pay, and their quality isn't as good.
That was Beth Husted, from Ramsey, Minnesota. Also, Kyle Mogensen from Andover, Minnesota. Coming up.
Trade has become a very controversial and increasingly unpopular topic.
And yet, this election. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 256 points this day after Election Day, 1.4%, 18,589. The NASDAQ up 57 points, about 1.1%, 5251. The S&P 500 up 23 points, 1.1%, 2163. Pharmaceuticals traded higher as investors bet the election result would make regulation of drug prices less likely. Pfizer up 7%, AstraZeneca shined up 2.8% today. Defense contractors got a boost as well. Lockheed Martin turned up almost 6%. Northrop Grumman climbed 5.4%. Private prison operators also gained. Correction Corporation of America sprang up 43.1%. Not a typo. The GEO Group jumped 21.25%. Bonds down. The yield up 2.06%. You're listening to Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Gusto. Let your employees know you've got their back by signing up for Gusto for payroll and HR. More than 300,000 small business owners use Gusto. They offer benefits like health insurance, employee onboarding, and more. Get your payroll taxes filed, deductions calculated, and your team paid fast. No more pain. Just the joy of running your business. Get 3 months free when you go to gusto.com/marketplace. That's gusto.com/marketplace.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rusnall. I went out on Twitter this morning and I asked people what questions they had about President-elect Trump and what will soon be his economy. And easily 70% of the answers were about Obamacare. Anecdotal, yes, but since almost before it became law, the public has been divided on the Affordable Care Act, and Republicans have been promising to repeal and replace it. Now, obviously, they have their chance, but it is one thing to talk about something when you don't actually have the power to do it. It's entirely another to have to deliver. From the help desk at WHYY, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein looks at what happens now.
Donald Trump has targeted health care as one of his top priorities.
When we win on November 8th, we will be able to immediately repeal and replace Obamacare.
The soonest that can happen is early next year when Congress begins, although he's floated ideas like selling insurance across state lines and using health savings accounts. Truthfully, nobody knows for sure what proposals we'll see. We do know 22 million people now have insurance, some through state Medicaid expansion, others through subsidies that help cover premiums. Those gains, says Harvard health policy professor John McDonough, are at risk.
There are so many people for whom coverage meant the difference between life and death.
GOP lawmakers have introduced their own reforms over the years. They've proposed barring some people who today qualify for Medicaid, offering less generous insurance subsidies, and making it harder again for people with pre-existing conditions to get insured. James Capretta is with the right-leaning American Enterprise Institute. He didn't back Trump in the election. Capretta expects lawmakers to come up with some kind of replacement, not just leave it at repeal.
I don't think they're going to do that. I think that they would have a very hard time politically doing that, and I think there's a lot of Republicans who would oppose doing that.
Capretta is fairly certain whatever shape this replacement takes, it will mean some people losing what they have today. An important question is whether members of Congress have the stomach to do something they rarely, if ever, do, take benefits away from their constituents. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Well, I think a lot of people expect him to make more jobs in America with factories, but I just don't think that's going to work because we're not equipped for that. And with the minimum wage being so high, the cost is going to be so high to produce things in the USA.
That was Jessica Longstreet there. She's from Pennsylvania. There was a great chart I saw in the blizzard of charts and data that was flying around last night. The degree to which Donald Trump outperformed Mitt Romney in the Rust Belt states this election versus 4 years ago. A lot is the short answer. So bearing in mind the promises the president-elect made during his campaign about bringing jobs back and reversing the decline in the Rust Belt, Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer looks at how or even whether that might work.
When Joe Del Signore opened his catering business back in 1987, the coal and steel mines of Johnstown, Pennsylvania, were booming. But Del Signore estimates over the years, the area lost thousands of jobs.
A
industries all closed down or moved out of the area. And of course, when you lost people, you know, there goes your customer base.
Now Del Signor has to work a 100-mile radius around Johnstown to get customers. His father always told him not to talk politics. But this year, he registered Republican and put a Trump sign in front of his business. Nobody complained.
I got all positive feedback on it, too, because people in this area do realize that we do need a change.
What kind of change?
Well, I think they would like to have decent jobs.
That's Ellen Meltzer, an economist at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh. He says people in the Rust Belt want
jobs that will provide a family living.
Meltzer says Trump has promised lower corporate taxes and less regulation, and that could bring in more private sector investment and jobs. But old-fashioned manufacturing, like in the 50s and 60s, won't be coming back to the Rust Belt, says Chad Bown of the Peterson Institute for International Economics. He says factory production is different now.
It's done now through automation and computers and robots that requires many, many fewer people to actually do the work.
Bown says Trump will need more than campaign promises to deliver the new manufacturing jobs his Rust Belt supporters now expect. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Among many other things, Donald Trump will very shortly be responsible for America's global trade policy, which is interesting because Mr. Trump spent a tremendous amount of time on the campaign trail attacking international trade overall, various U.S. trade deals, and American companies that manufacture things abroad. Marketplace's Mark Garrison reports now on what might happen next with trade.
The idea of a hardcore skeptic on trade and globalization in the White House is remarkable. This election smashes a pattern that has held for a long time.
It's been true for decades in America that whether we've had Republican or Democratic presidents and Congresses, there's been a sufficient set of people in Washington that voice the arguments for why trade and globalization more broadly do benefit America overall on average.
Matt Slaughter is dean of Dartmouth's Business School and a former White House economic advisor.
Those arguments still hold true in terms of the data, and yet for a set of reasons, primary of which is so many people worrying about their jobs and their own personal income for good reason, those arguments are not carrying the day.
What does have traction is a growing frustration among many Americans that globalization is hurting them more than helping. Trump's anti-trade message got him support in areas hit hard by manufacturing job losses. That seems to have helped him pull off those surprising wins in states like Pennsylvania and Ohio. The anti-trade rhetoric set off alarm bells in boardrooms of U.S. companies that do business overseas. Ishwar Prasad is a Cornell professor and author of Gaining Currency.
I think all American companies are hoping that once the heated rhetoric of the presidential election season dies down, that more reason will return to trade policies of the U.S. and that the U.S. will go back to promoting freer trade.
Hence the big question about the Trump administration. How much of that anti-trade talk was just to get votes and how much becomes policy? Trade deals are in the crosshairs, starting with the TPP between the U.S. and the Pacific region. The Obama administration thought it might be able to push it through the lame duck session of Congress. Kiss TPP goodbye, says Cowen and Company's Chris Krueger, veteran translator of Washington for Wall Street.
If possible, we would say less than zero. Mathematically, that's not possible, but there is literally no chance the Trans-Pacific Partnership will be enacted in the lame duck.
A Trump administration will go in the opposite direction. On the campaign trail, President-elect Trump attacked NAFTA, the decades-old trade deal between the U.S., Mexico, and Canada. He promised to pull the U.S. out unless terms are tilted in America's favor. He's also gearing up for big fights with China. There are now growing doubts about a future trade deal with Europe as skepticism grows on both sides of the Atlantic. Heather Conley directs the Europe program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies and is a former State Department official.
As trade has become a very controversial and increasingly unpopular topic, Europe is feeling the exact same strains. There is really becoming a growing anti-trade sentiment.
Add all that up and you have an environment where American companies that want an easier path to selling their stuff abroad are going to have a very hard time getting their way. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
We can't compete anymore in the global economy. Like, they call it the Rust Belt. These guys are just displaced. Even, like, getting a bachelor's degree, which is required for any job almost in this economy, is extraordinarily expensive. And we just have to make education more affordable and competitive.
That was Munif Saza from Washington, D.C. This final note on the way out today, it's final thought more like. I got a direct message on Twitter last night about 10 o'clock L.A. time, so the election was pretty much done. It was a kid named Sam, and he wrote, and this is a quote, "Kai, why is this happening? The first presidential election I get to vote in. Can it be okay? The global landscape seems so volatile." End of quote. I wrote him back, which I don't usually do, and I said, "I don't know, Sam. I don't know." And then I thought about it for a minute, and I wrote him again, and I said, "It is going to be okay. In the long run, it is. But in the short term, there's a whole lot of things that we're all going to have to work through, none of which are going to be easy, and most of which are going to have some real and very lasting economic consequences." All right, we got to go. The markets, you know, they were up. I did want to get this in here. There is a new edition of our podcast, Politics Inside Out, that dropped today. Me and our Washington Bureau Chief, Andrea Seabrook, on the economics of the politics of this week. It is available, of course, wherever you get your podcasts. Chris Clark, Brad Fisher, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Talladay engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We are here, as always, tomorrow, everybody. Have a good afternoon. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
"What is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?"
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.